You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, ants are some of nature's best farmers. We'll talk to a Wisconsin scientist about how their techniques have evolved over millions of years. Now the FBI says it foiled a plot to kidnap Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer and try her for treason before the November 3rd presidential election. Officials say the alleged conspirators discussed taking the governor to a secure location here in Wisconsin. They had been training with firearms and explosive devices. Governor Whitmer took aim at President Donald Trump, blaming him for not condemning a far-right extremist group during the presidential debate, instead telling them to, quote, stand back and stand by.
Hate groups heard the president's words not as a rebuke, but as a rallying cry.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What was your reaction to news about the plan to kidnap Michigan's governor? Some of these conspirators were part of a self-proclaimed militia group. Do you see those groups as a problem? How do you want to see state and federal lawmakers addressing these organizations and movements? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Brian Levin is a professor of criminal justice and director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University, San Bernardino. He's also on the board of the Wisconsin-based organization United Against Hate. Brian, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. And thank you so much for giving a shout out to these beautiful people at United Against Hate. I would be remiss, and it's a Wisconsin-based organization, and you can find it, and I'm bad at this. It's United Against Hate, but with a hyphen between all the words and then .org. They're a wonderful organization, and indeed, Wisconsin has been on the forefront of fighting hate for our country for many, many years. The first case to uphold the constitutionality of hate crime laws was a Wisconsin case out of Kenosha, that was decided back in 1993.
Now, looking at this self-proclaimed militia group, how do you see this, Brian, and this plot to kidnap the governor of Michigan fitting into wider movements, organizations around the country?
Wow, what a great question. You know, it seems each week we're chasing some other group. There's a scrum behind them. Here's the thing, and we've been saying this for some time, and I'm so glad that the Department of Homeland Security has now confirmed what we've been saying for years. They came out with a report just in the last week or so. And here's the thing. Post-Charlottesville, the white supremacist / far right world has dissipated. So while those hornet's nests have been broken up, the hornets are still flying around. And what we're afraid of is the biggest threat across ideologies, by the way, but in particular, though not exclusively, to far-right white supremacists, are these loners who have been incubated in an echo chamber, or these small semi-autonomous cells that have a shorter half-life and they're more violent, of the kind that we saw just in the last week.
And you've talked to us about this in the past, Brian. You see three different threads out there that could lead to these either these so-called lone wolf type actors or small groups, the white supremacists that you were talking about, the ISIS-inspired and other, militant Islamic-inspired groups, and groups on the left. Different ideologies, different themes, but they converge in some ways on tactics and online inspiration. Can you talk about common themes between the three?
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting. I want to be careful here because I can see the tomatoes lining up by my window. I am not saying that each of these groups manifest the same level of threat. There were 29 white supremacist / far-right homicides in 2019. That was the third consecutive increase, and it was more than any other ideology. In fact, it was more than all the extremists from the year before. But what we are seeing is the use of social media, and the white supremacist far-right have been quite adept. And one of the reasons why is I think that they have a much more elastic type of meeting place, if you will. What do I mean? I mean, the Liberate movement included mainstream people, people of goodwill, small business owners, traditional conservatives. There's some good people in there, absolutely. But it also got Second Amendment insurrectionists who believe that they can rise up with arms when the government goes against their bidding. We saw anti-vaxxers, we saw conspiracists, and we saw a similar thing with regard to Q. So bottom line is, some of these gathering places that exist on the right are elastic with respect to grievance or with respect to conspiracism. And that's where I think we're getting a lot of this problem now. That being said, the hard left is different. They tend to be better organized in certain localities, but certain not nationally with regard to the hard left. But all are taking advantage of a chaotic political season, and all kind of rely on the trajectory and gravitational pull of not only fellow travelers, but antagonists. But bottom line, the most prominent lethal threat right now is coming from the hard right because of their history, their folklore, their use of certain instrumentalities, and at the hardest fringe, there are folks who want to have mass casualty attacks. And that's different than some of the violence that we see in other parts of the political spectrum.
Talking to Brian Levin from the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University, San Bernardino, talking about the plot to kidnap Michigan's governor and issues of extremism and the risk of violence. Brian, we got an email from Daniel who says, can we stop calling them militia groups and start calling them what they are, and that's domestic terrorist organizations? I know there's been concern pointed at the media within the media, Daniel, about do you describe groups like this as militias, as they describe themselves, or as would-be at least terrorist organizations?
You know why I love doing public radio? Because you have the smartest listeners. Excellent point. Domestic terrorism is domestic terrorism is domestic terrorism. And we got to treat these folks like they're domestic terrorists, just like if they're from the Middle East as opposed to the Middle West, if you know what I mean. What we look at, though, is how do these entities manifest themselves? Well, these are paramilitary groups, and not all paramilitary groups are indeed militias. But bottom line is, domestic terrorists they are, but the subset of the kind that they are refer to these, you know, this term militia. But really, as far as the militia that's authorized by law, that's really the ones that are found after the 1903 Dick Act in the state National Guards. There is also some nomenclature which allows the government to recruit in an emergency from an unorganized militia that most of us belong to. But the bottom line is, the kind of thing that we saw was domestic terrorism. It was under paramilitary organizing, and militias are a type of paramilitary organization.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Bill is with us in Dodgeville. Bill, hi. Are you there, Bill? I think we lost Bill. We'll see if we can bring him back up, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Brian, how do we, I guess, turn the temperature down? I've seen some reports saying, hey, when you poll people, the number of people across the political spectrum who say violence is okay in pursuit of political ends, you know, it's not a majority, it's not even a plurality, but it's a decent number, and it's gone up over the years. How do you start to turn the tide on something like that?
Yeah, when you see that number, when you combine the political spectrum, right, that it's in the double digits, that's scary. Interestingly enough, we have seen over recent elections, election time being a period of increased intergroup violence and tension. Worst month this decade, disaggregated FBI hate crime data, November 2016. What did we see around it? A terrorist plot. Second worst month. When the House flipped from red to blue was October 2018. And interestingly enough, when we saw the flip go red, the violence came after the election, or at least accelerated more after the election. When it flipped the other way, as some are predicting will happen this time, the violence accelerated beforehand. So interestingly enough, the timing appears to play a role with intergroup conflict. And we saw it with Brexit too. Third worst month, Charlottesville month. And guess what? You know when hate crimes peaked? In the day of and after the very fine people statement by the president. So we have an idea that conflictual periods actually register with some of the data that we look at, whether it's extremist rhetoric online, hate crimes, or even the existence or plots or attacks. Remember that October 2018 times I talked about, the second worst month for hate crime? We saw the Tree of Life massacre occur just days before the election, and the killer referenced the caravans, which were a big political boogeyman during that prior election.
We're talking to Brian Levin, director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University, San Bernardino. He's also on the board of the Wisconsin-based organization United Against Hate. We're looking at extremist groups after the alleged plot to kidnap Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your reaction to the news about that plot aimed at kidnapping the governor of Michigan and to put her to some sort of trial here in Wisconsin? Do you worry about these self-proclaimed militia groups, what they might do on Election Day or in the days following? What questions do you have about extremism anywhere on the political spectrum and the risk of violence? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Brian Levin is with us, expert on hate and extremist groups. We're talking about the plot to kidnap Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer and the risks of extremism and violence here in the United States in 2020. You can join in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Jim is with us in Wausau. Jim, hi.
Hi, Rob and Brian. Hey, haven't called in for a long time, but just had a question here. You know, we talk about extremists, we use the phrase extremists, we use the phrase militia groups, we use the phrase now domestic terrorism. Okay, to me it's awful confusing, but on that part, Brian, have you talked to any militia groups or anything? And I'd like to know what they think of the extremes, which I guess would be taking of life or damage and things like that, which you would call domestic terrorists. How do they differentiate themselves, or what do they think?
Oh, great. What a great question. You know, it is an excellent question. On the hard right, there are different depths with regard to, for instance, belief in conspiracy theories or takes with regard to bigotry. And there are many people who are neither. But militia itself is a term of art within the Constitution, and I wrote a book on it. And the bottom line is that the militia that we had talked about in the Constitution is one that is now the National Guard. Some of these groups that are operating outside of government look at themselves as a quote civil guard, kind of like a hyper neighborhood watch. But there are others that are paramilitary groups that, unlike the militias of years past, aren't preparing for some disaster or conflict, but actually want to foment one. And the ones that exist today, and we put out a threat advisory back in April, are now concerned about overreach by state and local governments. Whereas in the past, groups like the ATF on the federal side were regarded as the more urgent enemy. But excellent question. Thank you for asking.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Brian, a thing that makes this hard to track and understand, I think, in social media is that a lot of these groups use irony and jokes. And sometimes when they're called on extremism, say, ha ha, you're just not in on the joke. And then we end up with the Boogaloo movement, which uses Hawaiian shirts. And it seems like they have tried to maintain this cloud of deniability. How do you cut through that?
You know, I love being on your show because you're always like a step ahead. That's one of the problems that we're having. What do? They use memes. They use visuals. What else? A lot of these entities rely on kind of this attachment, not so much to facts, but a visceral fear that exists. And what do some of these groups share across the spectrums, even across the different groups? Boogaloo Boys have really taken off. They've taken off in the past year or so on Facebook. And part of their appeal is that they're a subculture, almost a lifestyle and a quirk, and most people that adhere to them aren't going to be violent. The problem is they also embrace these folks who are looking for a civil war. And that goes back to a folklore of a racial holy war. So what happens is these subcultures, they go on these elastic reservoirs online, but they're also elastic with regard to the type of folklore and grievance and list of enemies that they have. And we saw that, if I can bring it up again, with the Liberate movement. There were plenty of people in there. There were small business people and people who were concerned about the extent and duration of some of the regulations. But within that way station, there was an echo chamber where different grievance groups could intertwine and some radicalize themselves. And we saw it happen with the plot in Michigan. Some of those folks showed up to protest and were armed earlier in the year in Lansing. So the problem is, don't regard it as a lark. If it's somewhat funny, if there's some kind of hook that might be interesting, either through entertainment or even through anxiety or fear, those are the kind of groups we got to be careful of, because it's a lot easier to get someone through the front door with that kind of thing, entertainment, a lark, or hitting some kind of grievance, than it is waving a swastika or a Klan hood.
Talking to Brian Levin, looking at extremism and hate after the alleged kidnapping plot targeting Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer. Back to your call. Joel is with us in Milwaukee. Joel, hi.
Hi. Obviously I consider terrorism bad, but I understand these groups that they feel desperate, I think, because the lockdowns and quarantines and mandates are so harsh, especially I've heard in Michigan that they're even fining people for not wearing masks. So I kind of sympathize with these groups, or at least I understand them, because all of these pandemic measures are too harsh.
Joel, thanks a lot for the call. But Brian, there's a difference between, like, you know, the Republican Party in Michigan or Wisconsin suing over these mandates, making similar arguments to what our caller did, and a plot to kidnap a governor over those mandates.
Absolutely. But here's the problem. We're seeing this kind of grievance, and the roots of this grievance is legitimate. But what we're seeing is when it's combined with these people who are manipulating social media, using conspiracism, saying that COVID's a hoax, or that there are only 9,000 cases, or saying that they're going to come take away your guns if they make you wear a mask. What we have here is, with regard to extremism, there's something called stochastic terrorism. And that is when an institution or person is identified as a legitimate target of aggression. We'll see that amplified on social media, and people who are unstable or under stress actually act out on it.
Thanks a lot for that call, Joel. Brian, what can leaders at the national level, at the state level, to effectively speak out against this kind of thing?
We need our national leaders to do so. Look, when the president introduced his Muslim ban proposal, 5 days after the San Bernardino terror attack, hate crimes against Muslims rose, and we saw threats against members of Congress after that. So what we see is a pattern, or Charlottesville, as I said, in the days after the Very Fine People statement, hate crimes increased 50% per day on that. So the day after election 2016, the worst day in 13 years. So what we see is a correlation to speech made by leaders, particularly those with the highest transmitter in the land. But the bottom line is, it doesn't appear that the president is going to do so. We have seen him retweet images of blacks attacking whites, and also a false crime data from someone under the handle of White Genocide TM. That's something that is going to escalate things. And unfortunately, at a time during election periods when we already see an enhanced risk of intergroup conflict, we now have this establishment of elections as somehow being rigged and requiring surveillance. This is a problem. We're concerned about it, and we'd like to see the Attorney General of the United States come out in public with some plan to secure election places. Also, We are intensifying our threat advisory from earlier in the year by expanding it to include journalists, people obviously involved in campaigns, and others. I'll tweet this stuff on Prof 11 if people are interested.
In our last couple of minutes, Brian, are you seeing federal law enforcement taking this seriously enough? We had the FBI director say the white supremacist threat was the biggest domestic terror threat in the United States now. Obviously, the arrests in Michigan, do they have their eye on the right ball here?
I think federal law enforcement does have their eye on the right ball, but I will also tell you in a statement that we made to Congress just a couple of weeks ago, the intelligence cycle of professionals within our government and also the research that's being done by outsiders like us who have called this threat for now a few years has been corrupted for political purposes, and that is unacceptable. I'll post that too. The problem is when you have a national security threat, we cannot have one exaggerated with regard to the scope, depth, and lethality to the expense of another, which is the most prominent at this time, which is white supremacist far right in a diversifying threat matrix. I'll post this stuff to Prof. Levin later this afternoon.
Brian, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
Brian Levin is a professor of criminal justice and director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University, San Bernardino. He's also on the board of the Wisconsin-based organization United Against Hate. He talked to us about self-proclaimed militia groups and threats of political violence in connection with the alleged plan to kidnap the governor of Michigan. Research led by UW-Madison has revealed some fascinating information about one of the world's tiny but mighty species, ants. A lot of ants are farmers, over 250 species, and in evolutionary terms, ants were very early adopters of farming. According to this new research, they figured out how to make the right partnerships to keep their crops thriving. Cameron Curry is the Ira L. Baldwin Professor of Bacteriology at UW-Madison. He was one of the lead researchers on this project, studying how ants created a relationship with bacteria to become successful fungus farmers. Cameron, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Ron.
Well, give us the time frame, first of all, of the particular ants you're looking at here.
So the ants we study are a tribe of ants that include, as you said, about 250 species that the estimate is that they evolved to do this fungus gardening and fungus growing about 50 to 65 million years ago.
Right. And people may be hearing this and not really thinking of ants as farmers, but they do a fair amount of different kinds of ant agriculture.
Yeah. In fact, our current available evidence suggests that they probably were the first farmers or some other groups of insects that will grow their own food. But these ants are one of the best examples of in nature of farming.
And this new research involves amber, right?
Yeah.
Ants caught in amber. Amber is this amazing thing. It seems like every few weeks we're finding cool information from the past trapped in amber. What are we looking at in this amber here?
So in terms of the study from the amber perspective, we got material for, that was captured from Dominican amber. These ants were embedded in the amber, estimated 15 to 20 million years ago. And what's really incredible about this is that we could see the microbial symbiont that we work on embedded within the amber. So what this means is that the ants were associating with this microbe 15 to 20 million years ago.
And talk about this relationship. Now, the ants are growing some kind of fungus, first of all.
Yes.
So what? Talk about the fungus and ant agriculture as it relates to them.
So the ants, you know, it's actually an incredibly fascinating and complex association. So the ants grow fungus for food, like we grow plants for our food. They cultivate.
We even grow mushrooms. We grow some fungus of our own.
We do. And like human farmers, the ants have problems with agricultural diseases, so pests of their fungus garden. And this pathogen is another fungus that attacks and consumes the fungus the ants are culturing. And if this fungus grows, it can grow very rapidly and completely devastate the fungus garden of the ants. So the organism we were focused on is actually a fourth player in the system. So it's actually bacteria the ants use that produces antibiotics that helps protect the fungus from the pathogenic fungus.
And part of the interesting story is, if I have this right, the ants, if their body shape evolved to have little nooks and crannies for this helpful bacteria that helps stop this blight?
Yeah, so the a major aspect of the study is kind of studying these structures. And these structures, in some ants, can be incredibly elaborate. And in one way of thinking about it is the ants can be completely outlined with crypts or cavities. So these are kind of embedded within the exoskeleton of the ant. And inside the cavity is where the bacteria grows. And so these structures change and have changed in incredible ways over the 50, 65 million years of this association.
So you've got, a time scale over millions of years of how these ants change, their bodies actually change to be better carriers of this helpful bacteria?
Yeah, yeah. And if you're a researcher on ants, these changes are incredibly elaborate and fascinating, and there's many different varieties of changes in the structure. But what's really exciting for us is that the changes in the structure and the multiple origins of these structures indicate these ants have been using these bacteria for production antibiotics for tens of millions of years. And that's what's particularly exciting about our study.
Right. And this is this interesting study in evolution. And it didn't happen just once, you're saying.
Yeah. So originally, we've known about these antibiotic-producing bacteria for almost two decades now. And originally, it was thought it originated once in the association. It maybe originated, you know, relatively recently or maybe 10 million years ago. We weren't really sure. But what we show is that not only did it evolve at the very early origin of this association and was, you know, therefore indicating it's really critical, the success of the growing of the fungus garden by the ants, but that there's multiple origins of the structures that maintain it across the evolutionary history of the association. And that indicates that there's strong selection on the ants to protect their bacterial symbiont.
So the ants have this evolutionary pressure in effect. The better a carrier they are for this bacteria, the happier a home they provide, the more likely they are to have a successful fungus crop and then live.
Yeah.
What's in it for the bacteria? Do we know if the bacteria are evolving to be happier to be with these ants that bring them to the food they want?
Yeah, so that's a great question. The bacteria are only known to be certain members of these bacteria are only known to be associated with the ants. So the ants provide the niche where these bacteria occur. So that's a major benefit. But the other benefit they receive from the ants is under these elaborate structures inside the ant are actual gland cells that are connected to these crypts and these cavities through little channels, and the ants through the glands are feeding the bacteria. So the nutrients for the bacteria are derived from the ants. So it's really ants cultivating and culturing bacteria in their bodies to produce these antibiotics.
And the story I'm hearing here is evolution in some ways works more in more complicated ways than I learned it. You know, we learned the gazelle runs faster to get away with from the cheetah. The cheetah runs faster to catch up with the gazelle. Yeah. These are different species co-evolving together, sort of competing with yet a third and fourth species, the two different kinds of fungus.
Yeah, it's a whole community of organisms that, you know, play different roles. And one of the fascinating aspects of, you know, microbiology right now is the recognition of the importance of beneficial microbes and the complexities of communities. As you may know, there's a lot of research going on the human microbiome and the microbes on our skin and our mouths and our nose and in our guts, mediating human health. And so this is a really great system for understanding how hosts and beneficial microbes evolve.
So we might be interested as humans in studying things like how microbiomes can help us fight different kinds of disease, especially in the world of antibiotic resistance.
Yeah, and that's a major part of the research we do in the lab is thinking about understanding antibiotic resistance in this system, but also we look for new antibiotics from these bacteria in the ants. We've discovered a number of new compounds produced by these bacteria that have antimicrobial properties that we're exploring as new antimicrobial drug leads.
And maybe are there lessons here just briefly for agriculture? If they were fighting fungus, we're trying to fight some kinds of fungus.
Yeah, there's the potential for some of the compounds to be used, and there's also the potential to understand how the ants deal with resistance, and informing on our own attempts to grow crops.
Well, Cameron, thanks a lot for sharing your research with us today.
Thanks, Rob.
Cameron Curry is the Ira L. Baldwin Professor of Bacteriology at UW-Madison. He's been one of the lead researchers in the study of fungus farming ants and their evolution to be successful farmers. In the last academic year, more than 14,000 UW system students used counseling services offered through their campuses. That's according to a reporting project to assess the impact of that counseling. The UW Board of Regents wanted to know specifically how students' behavioral or mental health was influenced by the onset of the pandemic earlier this year. Sandy Cox helped present the findings to the Regents last week. She's director of the Counseling Center at UW Oshkosh. Sandy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob. It's an honor to be here with you.
First, can you tell us a little bit about what you and the Regents were hoping to find out in this report?
Absolutely. Well, the UW system and the Board of Regents have really prioritized mental health and really understanding what college student mental health looks like and how they can best support it. So this presentation was really designed to understand how has the pandemic really impacted students and what are our campuses doing to support them through these challenging times.
What did you learn about how students did in this, as you say, very challenging time?
Absolutely. So, you know, students are very resilient. That's one thing that we know that's come about through what they're telling us through this. They have learned how to bounce back. You know, they've really learned how to develop some positive coping skills to get through difficult times. And they're really paying more attention to their mental health, which is so important. I mean, aren't we all paying a little bit more attention to our mental health right now through difficult times that we're going through? But one of the things we did really learn is that, you know, historically, the top reasons why students come to college counseling centers are for anxiety, depression, and stress. And that hasn't changed through the pandemic. What has changed is that it's at greater distress that they're expressing. So it's more anxiety, more depression, you know, more stress, more feeling overwhelmed. And then the addition that we've really seen a great deal of, too, is loneliness. So students who maybe already were experiencing those things are now experiencing them at a greater level. And students who never experienced any of those things are now experiencing them because of all the challenges we have going on in our world right now.
Is there a sense here that students were closer to a mental health crisis at these moments when they reached out to counseling than they might have been in a normal year, whatever that means?
Absolutely. It is always hard, especially in the mental health world in college counseling centers. Normal is not really ever normal. But you are right that students are responding at a higher crisis level. But that's to be expected. There's so many things that students are having to face these days, like the rest of us. But then they are also, you know, young and they're learning of how to cope through these really challenging times. This might be the first time they've ever had to really work through something as difficult as this. So, yes, they are coming in at more crisis, but that's also a great thing. That means that they are seeking help. And help is such a hard thing. You know, help-seeking behaviors is a really hard thing to do. And they're learning that skill through this to seek help.
How do you spread that message that help-seeking behavior is a good thing, that it is not only okay to ask for help with mental and emotional troubles, it's a positive thing to do, whether we're talking to students or anybody?
Absolutely. So, you know, one of the things that we're using for one of our campaigns is, you know, we all need a little support right now. And isn't that true? We all need a little support to get through all the things that we're having to deal with right now in our world and our lives. But also, you know, students just need to know that mental health is everyone's concern, that you don't have to have mental health struggles to pay attention to your mental health. We all have physical health. If something goes wrong, we break our foot, we go see the doctor, or we, you know, get that fixed. We all have mental health. And we really want to make sure that everyone understands that mental health means just the way that we experience life. Are we experiencing it in good ways? Are we coping in good ways? Because one thing we do know is that the more positive that you cope with difficult times, the more positive your mental health is. And the more positive your mental health is, the more that you're going to experience everything in your life in a positive way. And that's what we want for our students on our campuses, is to leave their time with us, you know, academically successful and ready to go and get a good career, and also personally well.
Talking to Sandy Cox, director of the Counseling Center at UW Oshkosh, a part of a new report on the mental well-being of students and counseling services available. Sandy, earlier this year, I talked to a couple of counselors who work with the general population in different parts of Wisconsin about the transition from in-person to virtual counseling. How much of that have you had to do in the UW system, and how has it worked?
Absolutely. We had to do it completely and very fast. You know, come March, our universities very much changed. Most universities in Wisconsin went to virtual, which meant that we had to go virtually very fast as well, too. And we had to transition quickly because everyone was in greater distress quickly. So we couldn't hesitate to figure out how we could support them. But I have to say, for us, the students have just remarkably responded to the changes. Of course, you're always going to prefer to be in person to see somebody, you know, have that type of building of relationship. But they have done so well in responding to virtual services. You know, that survey you indicated too, Rob, is showing that that they really felt that these virtual services have helped them to be well. Like 91% of our students who went to the counseling center endorsed that. That's pretty amazing that we were able to do that so quickly and so well.
Now that you've got this survey in hand, we're, of course, in a new-ish school year, a couple months into this term. Now, what lessons have you learned that are maybe shaping reactions and services in the future?
Absolutely. So we've learned that there is some room for this teletherapy services. It reaches students who maybe wouldn't be able to seek services or were just too anxious or too, you know, other challenges to go in. So I think that there's going to be a part of the teletherapy services moving forward that are going to be useful to some students. But we've also learned that students very much are desiring that relationship building, that in person, that putting down their technology and developing relationships with people. So we really want to encourage that. That's something I think we've all wanted for college students for a long time. And this is an opportunity to do that. And I think we're going to have some opportunities in the future to engage students in ways we never have, because they're really thirsty for that level of engagement.
So that message, and again, this could apply to everyone, not just students, the importance of having that social connection, even if it's only online right now, that is really a, I guess, protective factor when it comes to our mental and emotional well-being?
It is, Rob. Like, one of the biggest things, connection is one of the greatest indicators of our personal happiness. The less connected we feel to people, the less happy we are. And so we really are needing to stay focused on connection and finding ways, any way we can, even through all these challenges, to find connection. And although it can be challenging, students are finding that there's some unique ways. You know, they're building maybe a little bit deeper relationships with people because your support circle's gotten a little smaller, or you're just all going through challenging times. So, you know, whenever you are with somebody through challenging times, there's a naturalness of connection growing deeper. So there are some really good connections things coming out of this, and I look forward to students being able to be back closer together.
And briefly, Sandy, this report's kind of looking back. Right now, are you and your colleagues seeing a lot of demand from students for this kind of counseling?
Yes, we are. We, in all honesty, we always have been seeing demand. The demand keeps increasing every single year, but the demand is definitely increasing again right now because of the level of distress that students are experiencing.
Sandy, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Rob.
Sandy Cox is director of the Counseling Center at UW Oshkosh. She talked with us today about how the coronavirus pandemic affected the mental health of UW System College students. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow at 8, Kate and her guests look at the opening day of Supreme Court confirmation hearings and what comes next. Join the conversation with your thoughts and your questions. That's tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we've got a couple interesting topics for you. Our own look, of course, at the Supreme Court nomination process. And then novelty is important to the human brain. We'll find out why and how we can shake things up if we're in the midst of a pandemic routine. That's coming up next here on Central Time on the Ideas Network.